Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors. For over 50 years, visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at RackSteel.com. Now joining us from ESPN to chat Four Nations and maybe a little bit of NHL around the league stuff as well. He is Greg Wyshynski. Wish, thanks for doing this, man. How are you?
Is there still room to talk about NHL things? What with, let's see, sucking all the oxygen out of the room, the buzz palpable.
We'll see.
Battle of international powers.
Now, it's interesting because I have been on record. I'm extremely hyped for this tournament. I'm a huge mark for international hockey. I love it. I'm always hyped. But as I'm sure you've seen as well, you know, a fair amount of skepticism, I think, from a lot of fans. And we're getting into the inbox here right now. You know, all these guys aren't going to go hard. Is it going to be a glorified all-star game? What kind of intensity are you expecting to see in this tournament?
Well, I think that the environment's going to be a big factor here. Like, it's hard to imagine that even if these guys in the U.S. and Canada are treating this thing like it's an exhibition tournament and the effort is going to be somewhere between an all-star game and the World Cup, like, those boys stand across the ice from those guys wearing Maple Leafs on their chests
yep.
in Bell Center on a Saturday night, and it's 20,000 or so fans waving little mini Canadian flags and booing the anthem. Like, it's hard to imagine there's not going to be a modicum of effort put into that game. And the same thing for the earlier game that day, too, with Sweden and Finland. I mean, like, I was actually just doing an interview with a Swedish newspaper talking about that game. And, yeah, it's not as important to them as the Olympics or as important to them as Worlds and the World Cup. But it is a chance to take on Sweden if you're Finland and Finland if you're Sweden, and that game does mean something back home. So I think Saturday will be a lot of fun. I can't speak to the rest of the tournament, but it's hard to imagine the effort won't be there, at least for those two rivalry games.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see tomorrow. I think that's a very good point. As you said, the Canada, U.S., Saturday night in Montreal, like, I think it's almost impossible to be as competitive as these guys are and not get the juices flowing in that situation. I do wonder another thing. You know, Sidney Crosby and his status was in doubt. And, you know, so much of the talk about this tournament has been like, hey, guys like Austin Matthews and Connor McDavid, Cale Makar, finally the chance to play best on best for their countries. You know, Crosby is one of the guys here, like, he has nothing to prove, obviously, internationally. He's got that on his resume. And yet he had an easy out with injury, but he made the decision to be there. He says, I'm good to go. How important do you think that could be for kind of the future of this event, the prestige of this event, to have Sidney Crosby going to great lengths to be a part of it?
I think it's cute you think this isn't a one and done. Like, you think this is going to be an ongoing. Like,
they say they want it, don't they? Or, like, the world, I guess they want to transition back to the World Cup.
Literally, the only reason we're having this is because they couldn't figure out how to have Russia in the tournament and keep Finland and Sweden in the tournament. Like, that's the only reason this thing exists. It's a cheat code around the fact that they couldn't have some of their best players representing their country in another World Cup. So I'm a little skeptical that we'll see this again. In fact, I would venture if they ever did this again, it might just be a straight up Canada USA thing. Which I know some people think it should have been anyway this year, but I understand, you know, when you have a chance to generate some international interest and revenue by having a Sweden-Finland game in prime time in both those countries, you take that chance and you do it. I'm a little skeptical that we're going to see this again. But as far as Crosby's participation, look, it's the reason that we're excited about this is for the thing you mentioned, which is the fact that we've had these generations of players, both in the U.S. and Canada, that have not had a chance to represent their countries in a best-on-best tournament because of the Olympic situation and because a lot of them were on Team North America during the World Cup or not even in the NHL quite yet. So that's the gimmick, and that's something to be really excited about. So, you know, the idea that you wouldn't have Sid playing with all these guys, McKinnon and McDavid and all them, for the first time would be kind of a bummer. And then the other thing, too, about Sid is that he's a very rational, logical human being. I think he knows his opportunity is to do this sort of thing are dwindling through each passing year. And I know that, you know, despite some seasons in which he maybe did not feel up to snuff to participate in the All-Star game, as he's matured and as he's gotten older, he's been one of these guys that is a good ambassador of the league for this kind of event. So I'm not shocked that he found a way to play in it, and I obviously think it's to the benefit of the tournament that he did.
Greg, over under 2.5 Donald Trump tweets about Matthew Tkachuk.
I don't know. He stayed out of sports for a while after taking it on the nose with the Chiefs yesterday. You know, he was you guys probably didn't see it up there, but he did an interview before the game, like putting over Pat Mahomes and Brittany Mahomes as two of his favorites, because I think she's a MAGA supporter. And then, you know, he left before the end of the game because of the Chiefs just getting trounced. So I don't know. I don't know if he'll venture into this, but I do think we'll probably, I think there's a better chance that we'll see him put something on Truth Social about Canada being the 51st state than about any specific player. I'm sure he'll use the opportunity of that game to continue his saber rattling, as it were, about Canada's status in the world.
One of the reasons I expect this to be a lot of fun is I actually think it matters a lot to the players. And the moment one hit gets thrown or you know, the moment the competitive atmosphere amps up even a little bit, I think you're going to get a pretty extraordinary buy-in from both teams given that. What do you expect, and is that your sense as well?
So that's a tricky question, because I don't think – leading up to this, I got a sense from the players that it mattered a lot. I'll be honest with you. Whenever I would talk to guys, their head down in playoff races, they're not thinking about this tournament. I think Linus Allmark the other day had an interview where they're asking him about like Four Nations, and he's like, I just got healthy. Like, I'm worried about trying to get Ottawa into the playoffs. This is not top of mind for me. So if they can flip the switch and get into this tournament and you know, having it be as lengthy as it is, having them up there now and practicing and stuff, like, I do think there's going to be a certain mindset they'll be able to get into to really, you know, get into the vibe of this tournament and play really hard. Where I'm confident there will be buy-in is in the players that don't necessarily have their tickets punched for 2026 yet. Because we have to remember that at the end of the day, this is just an appetizer for the main course of the Olympics. And especially on the American side, like, you've got a number of forwards on this team that really need to solidify their spots, because when they look over their shoulder, they see Tage Thompson, they see Cole Caulfield, they see a number of guys that probably could have made this team, Clayton Keller, but did not, because they decided to kind of go with more of a veteran 200-foot player thing versus some of the real young offensive dynamos that they have waiting in the wings. And so I do think, at least on the American side, I'm sure it's the same thing in some cases on the Canadian side, you do have players that are going to have to use this as an audition to make sure that their spots for the tournament that really matters are solidified.
One of the big stories here, of course, Quinn Hughes withdrawing from Team USA for this tournament. And, you know, really sounds like it was a tough decision for him. Obviously, his brother is going to be there, and that would have meant a lot for him. But he stays out of it. And, you know, we've been banging the drum all season, really, about, hey, Quinn Hughes, best defenseman in the world. Quinn Hughes, Hart Trophy candidate, all that. You've heard it all from Vancouver. How much does him withdrawing from this tournament, not getting this stage, kind of delay or derail our attempts to convince the rest of the world that he is the best defenseman?
What a bummer, right? Like, the Americans could have rolled out like Quinn Hughes and Zach Werenski for, like, you know, over two-thirds of the game, and just like, all right, that's we're in good hands. But not to be. Honestly, I do think there's going to be some opportunities for players in this tournament to make headway in awards conversations. Connor Hellebuyck probably already has the Vezina on lock, even though our last awards watch showed that Logan Thompson made some inroads. Obviously, if he comes away from this thing with a shutout against Canada or something, then you might as well just etch the trophy. I think Anthony Cirelli is an interesting one. He's someone who right now is not necessarily at the top of the Selke consideration. I think both the Florida boys, Barkov and Reinhardt, are ahead of him in the ranking. If he comes out and is playing and you know, spearheads a line that shuts down, say, like Austin Matthews or something, well, then all of a sudden he gets the spotlight a little bit more probably in that conversation. When it comes to Quinn, though, you know, ultimately, I think it comes down to a couple of factors. One, how much support is there for Hellebuyck as the non-traditional Hart Trophy candidate, if you will?
Mm-hmm.
Because I do think that, you know, as you see the percentage of the Jets wins this guy has and the stats that he's put up beyond that, it's a pretty compelling case for him to be, I think, the fifth guy since they changed the Vezina criteria in the 1980s to sweep the Vezina and the Hart. And then it also matters, like, how cannibalistic is it between Dreisaitl, MacKinnon, and Kucherov insofar as the other those stealing votes from each other. And then obviously, you know, probably above all of it is whether or not Vancouver actually makes the playoffs, which is, as Drance knows, the usual point of demarcation for an MVP candidate in the eyes of many voters, myself included.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to have a big part to play. And, you know, we'll see if he is healthy for the Canucks down the stretch after the Four Nations here. And, you know, you mentioned, like, obviously, there might be some awards position jockeying as a result of the tournament. You mentioned the guys fighting to secure a spot or at least help their odds of making the Olympics in a year's time. Who would you say at this tournament has the most to gain from a really good performance or a successful tournament, whether it's an individual, a country, coach? Who do you think has the most to gain at the Four Nations?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, I think, I don't know if it's an individual for me, but I do think that from an American standpoint, like, you want to see some proof of concept. You know, the anticipation for this group finally coming together and representing their country with a generation that includes the Hugheses, the Tkachuks, Austin Matthews, Jack Eichel, you know, goaltending that goes probably like six deep if they're all healthy. There's been an anticipation around USA Hockey about this moment because it's been considered to be the moment when they had their best shot at winning gold since they won it last in 1980. So I think from a sort of a macro standpoint, the most pressure is on these guys to show that there is that spark of potential to come together and do something really special in 2026. It's not, you know, they won't be able to do it if they lose this tournament or anything like that, but you want to kind of see, okay, well, they have the firepower to stand toe to toe with Canada. You know, they can, you know, win convincingly against the Sweden. Like they need to kind of show that they're on the right path. And if not, then maybe we see some retooling with some of the younger players that I mentioned before. But I think overall, like the mindset for USA Hockey in previous tournaments was, let's try to grind it out against Canada. And this is the first time where the grinders are also 30-goal guys. And I'm intrigued to see how that all plays out.
Wish, moving on to sort of the NHL and the Canucks specifically, you know, we're sort of just over, like we're 10 days out, basically, from JT Miller being traded to New York. We've seen, you know, the Canucks play four games now in the post-Miller era. We've seen the Miller era extend for four games, mostly successful for the Rangers. What do you make of what you've seen in the fallout of this? Is it just a matter of both sides really look like they're exhaling and pretty happy with life post-divorce?
Well, I don't, I mean, obviously Miller's, you know, picked up some points for the Rangers and played the kind of hockey that you'd expect from him. And I know that, you know, their whole thing with this was not only the points that they could produce, especially a 5-on-5, but also trying to change the tone and tenor of that team a little bit. And I think that's an ongoing thing for them. I don't think it's going to end with the acquisition of Miller. I think they want to change the DNA of that core a bit more in the offseason too. The trade itself, I don't know if we've talked since then, but like the trade itself, obviously the Canucks' hands are tied because of the no movement clause and everything, but I'm a big Phil Hedel guy. Like I know that there is the injury concern and there will always be the injury concern. And, you know, the injuries are the reason why he maybe didn't get the shots that he deserved in New York. But when he got those shots, when he got those opportunities, his points per 60, I think, was second only to Panarin on that roster at 5-on-5. Like he's a very, very good player. And I think that, given the opportunity and given some good luck injury-wise, he could be a real factor in balancing out this trade a bit more than maybe people anticipate. But for me, obviously, it comes down to, you know, what does Elias Pettersson look like now that he doesn't have the toxicity around him anymore? You know, does he exhale a little bit? Can he become himself a little bit more? And then more critically, how much runway are they willing to afford him to do all of that? You know, I don't buy the idea they're going to turn and flip him by March 7th. I don't buy that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't buy it. But, you know, if it's the rest of the season and he's still not himself, you know, do they revisit it in the offseason? Or is this, you know, basically planting the flag and saying, this is an Elias Pettersson team and we're going to do right by him and give him the time that he needs this season and next season to figure himself out?
Yeah, and I think you're right. They're not. I do think he's off the block. I do think he was off the block almost from the moment that they completed the second wave of the Miller deal, like the Marcus Pettersson deal subsequently. But yeah, I do think the jury will be out based on what happens now. Can you think of, like, is there another analogous situation that stands out in your mind when you think about, like, a guy who's point per game from 19 to 25 and, you know, is now pacing to be like a 55-point guy with all this baggage and drama around him over the course of the season? I mean, does this remind you of anything else? Like, I kind of am struggling to find an analogy, frankly, in my 20 years, 30 years watching hockey really closely, Wish.
Well, no, and I think the reason why we both struggle with it is because we've not had a situation where it was such an interpersonal conflict that may have led to some of this decline statistically. Like, there's been guys that, you know, maybe needed a change of scenery or what have you, and, you know, you see it here and there. Yeah, hell, you're seeing it in New York now with Zibanejad, where they can't figure out what's going on with him. But for a guy of Pettersson's age, and with the clear sort of through line of an internal situation leading to potentially to the struggles he's having to, you know, become a 100-point center again, I can't recall another situation, which is, again, why they're being so delicate with it, which is why they're being so cautious about it. He's an enormously talented player and easily the kind of player where if you ever decided to cut ties with him because of all of this, he goes someplace else and is, you know, putting up 100 points again. Like, he's, the sky's the limit. But again, you know, he's going to have to start playing well because there is probably a ticking clock insofar as, all right, we've made a dramatic move to help you. And now that we've done that, you got to help us by becoming the player that we assumed you were when we signed you to that contract.
Wish, really appreciate the time, man, and hopefully it's a fun tournament this week.
I think so. I mean, if nothing else, it's going to be a chance to wet our whistles before the Olympics and get a little Patriot pride. I do wish that the undercurrent of politics hadn't infected U.S.-Canada relations, because it does really cramp my style to be all jingoistic and patriotic and say we're going to, you know, there's nothing more I like than to go into a game like that and be like, we're going to conquer Canada. But it's hard to say that when we might actually conquer Canada.
I got to say, I do wonder to what the degree, if any, the NHL is regretting having that game in Montreal. Because of all the cities, it's going to be a wild, wild scene on Saturday in Montreal.
It is going to be a scene. I don't know if you guys have noticed, but the NHL, not really a fan of politics coming into their game. So I think it's going to be unavoidable. And I do think that, you know, as we get closer to that game, you're going to start to see a lot of very pointed and interesting questions from Canadian journalists towards the American players. And I imagine they're already thinking about how they'll dutifully avoid them.
I was going to say, players love talking politics, right? They love getting those sorts of questions. So it'll be another exciting part of the tournament for them. Thanks, Wish. We really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
That is Greg Wyshynski from ESPN joining us here and weighing in on the Four Nations.
Pretty comfortable talking politics off record.
Wish? Oh, the players.
yeah.
Yeah, on record, not as much. They're not crazy about it.
No, nor should they be.
No, I wouldn't be either. I don't like talking about it on our show. I mean, we almost never do. It never comes up. It's kind of awkwardly come up recently, but, like, yeah, I don't want to bring it up on our show.
I only bring it up to set the stakes of this tournament, which I've been saying for like a month. I remember I brought it up on the crossover like 6 weeks ago, and you guys all three of you looked at me like I'd grown a second head. It was like my most panned take.
I don't know if it was that or as much as it was like surprise that you were bringing it up, but that you were going there.
Fair enough.
Text came in, and just, you know, about that conversation about who has things to gain and all of that from the Four Nations. And Mike, the urologist from Brockville, of course, texts in, how hopeful are you that Petey uses the Four Nations as a springboard to consistent great play? He says, after the San Jose game, I thought no chance. Now suddenly I'm 50-50 because I'm a fool, obviously. And that mirrors some of what I was saying off the top of the show, right? Like, just when I declared that I was out on his performance for this season, you see that glimmer and he pulls you back in. You start hoping again. I do think, and I know Rick Tocchet was asked about this on Saturday, you know, like, hey, you guys have won three in a row, getting that buy-in. Do you kind of wish the break wasn't happening? And he was kind of like, no, it's good to have the break. We need guys need to reset, all that sort of thing. I think for Pettersson, if he had, let's say the San Jose game had been the last game before the break and he was going in after that kind of low point of the season, I think that would be very, very tough. I think going in to the break with a good performance under your belt, as Rick Tocchet said, like, hey, he was having fun. That's what we want. I do think it sets up as a chance for him, like, okay, build on that. You started to have fun. You're going to play with your countrymen. You're representing your country. You're not the most high-profile player on the team. You're not necessarily part of the leadership group there. You can be a little looser. Build on that. Rediscover some of that passion, that fun for the game, and maybe you can come back and carry that over to the Canucks after the Four Nations. Like, again, am I saying lock it in? That's what's going to happen? No. But that kind of glimmer of hope from the Toronto game makes me at least more interested, more curious about whether we could see something like that from Pettersson after the tournament.
I mean, we'll see. Like, it was nice to see him have some juice and jump against the Maple Leafs. I think that should give us some hope that maybe this isn't, you know, one of those things where he's going to need a full offseason, but I sort of still suspect he will. You know, more than anything, it was the speed was a little bit back.
Yep.
against the Maple Leafs. If we see that, if we see the first couple steps have a little bit of juice to them, when we're watching this for Four Nations tournament on television, I'll have hope for what he could do down the stretch. But for so much of the past few weeks and months, it's been that lack of juice more than anything that stood out to me. I know there's been all this conversation about confidence and decision-making and on, or puck handling or the yips or what have you. And for me, it's just been, if he doesn't have burst on his first few steps, he's not going to be able to get there. He was able to get there against the Maple Leafs. And even before that shift, you could kind of see that he had a little bit more jump than he's had for most of the season. If we're watching this Four Nations tournament and we see that jump, then I'll probably come back and say, hey, there's a chance that was a springboard to something. If his skating looks the way it has for most of the season, I won't feel that way. And so it's really just that simple for me. It's the first few strides. Is there burst there or is there not? And I'll set my expectations based mostly on that.
All right, that's this segment, the first hour in the books. We've got an open segment coming up next, so we can do a little more Canucks-focused talk. You know, Pat Brisson, agent for both Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes, was on Donnie and Dolly with some interesting comments we can get into. You have a piece up at The Athletic as well, Drance, looking at some trade deadline targets at center specifically for the Canucks. And I think it's kind of worth discussing the trade.
I talked myself in to pursuing Braden Schenn while writing that piece, so. Looking forward to discussing.
And I think it's also worth kind of just like the big picture view, like the center targets as well, but the big picture view on the deadline. Canucks only have six games before the trade deadline all of a sudden, right? So the extra information they're going to get between now and March 7th is not very much. So lots to get into on the other side here. You can text in as well. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Denny's True North taste awaits with Denny's 100% Canadian beef burgers made with new shredded iceberg lettuce on a brioche bun and all the classic ingredients you love. More Canucks talk on the other side here on Sportsnet 650. To Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We're broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV Discovery and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. So, as I teased before the break that we'd be doing a little trade deadline discussion, and you have the piece up at The Athletic today, Drancer. And I actually mentioned it's a joint piece with Harmon Dial.
Yeah. So we'll get into the center thing shortly, but can we just quickly use this open segment? I want to talk a little bit of Super Bowl.
All right. Now, but other than the fact that it was the least entertaining game that I can remember watching.
Well, I love bad football, as you know, so I didn't mind at all. I was completely riveted by watching that game, to be totally honest with you. I also had a lot on Hurts MVP, so I was enjoying it immensely. Now, watching that game, I had a couple of thoughts, Canucks-centric thoughts, to be totally honest with
all
you,
right.
Just like what matters in sports thoughts. So I want to quickly get into it. The first is what I loved about that game is, so there's this thing like during the Patriots Way era, Bill Belichick, New England Patriots teams, when you show up to training camp, the first 2 days of camp included drills focused on only two things. Do you know what those two things were, Jamie?
What?
Blocking and tackling.
Yep.
The first 2 days, blocking and tackling. Like, at the end of the day, you can have as many trick plays as you want. You can have Patrick Mahomes. You can have, all of these weapons and weaponry and the best wide receivers. And fundamentally, football comes down to blocking and tackling. Who blocks best? Who tackles best? And the Eagles won that because their offensive line held up better than the Chiefs did. And their D-line absolutely ran roughshod over them. Really, like, reminded me of that, like, Broncos-Panthers Super Bowl about a decade ago. Like, there was just no chance for Patrick Mahomes. And what's kind of funny is the Chiefs were also like the second best tackling team in football, right? Like for all that we talk about, tush pushes or anything else, like tackling and blocking. These were the teams that tackled the best and blocked the best all season. And one of them overpowered the other in the trenches, and that's why they won. And this is why, you know, when like the hockey equivalent, right? That I always come back to and that I always discuss is the ability to create an environment where you're more likely than your opponent to score the next goal 5-on-5, right?
It's not quite as pithy as blocking and tackling, but...
No, it's not. It's not. It's more complicated.
Yeah.
But hockey is a, you know, there's no 40 seconds to draw up your play. There's no regularized change of possession, right? Hockey is a far more frenetic game where you're always both attacking and defending, whether you have the puck or not, right? Like there are aggressive attacking moves you can make in the defensive zone, you know, in a stationary defensive situation, right? Blowing the zone, punt and hunt, all sorts of things you can do to manufacture offense without the puck. Likewise, there's puck management decisions that you make with the puck that are defensive, conservative, right? So it's a more frenetic game, but fundamentally, it's about creating that environment. And as much as we like to say things like defense wins championships, and that's true, you know, in this contemporary NHL, what we've seen repeatedly I'd say spiking frequency over the last couple of years is that manufacturing chances has become the primary skill of great teams. Manufacturing scoring chances is what the best teams do. And that's why, you know, that Florida-Edmonton Stanley Cup final last year with the two teams that generate the most chances in the league was, you know, in some ways like the... I see some, a similarity or consistency, a kinship with that Super Bowl matchup where it's like the two best blocking and tackling teams faced off in the Super Bowl. So this is sort of the, one of the things that I take away from this is, you know, championship teams do the thing that matters most the best, period. And that's where the Canucks have struggled, especially in non-Hughes minutes over the course of the season. And as I reflect on what we've seen this last week from Vancouver, you know, I think where I guess I'm a little bit heartened or at least curious to see more, because we're fundamentally analyzing a new team and we've only seen them play 205-on-5 minutes. So we know nothing about them again, right? We're back to, at no point this season, frankly, have we known anything about the Canucks from a true talent or hockey perspective. Injuries and drama and all this noise have sort of prevented it. But what's sort of interesting is the Canucks have played pretty well 5-on-5, and all of it is non-Hughes minutes. Now it hasn't been great. They haven't had like a ton of offensive juice, 4 5-on-5 goals across those four games. You know, it's not like they're ventilating teams or crushing them. They've also had 960 goaltending, which I think makes everything, like, that's a hell of a drug in terms of twisting our perception of how well a team is playing. But at the very least, they've sort of won their minutes 5-on-5, and they're all non-Hughes minutes. Like, if Vancouver's non-Hughes minutes look like they have across those last four games durably, this team is definitely a top five team in the Western Conference. Now, I don't know if that stands up, right? Like, I'm not predicting that that's the case, but at the very least, I'm open-minded about seeing more of it. Right, I'm curious to see how much of it is sustainable in terms of what this team's able to accomplish in those non-Hughes minutes with sort of a deeper forward group and with a deeper defensive group, albeit without JT Miller, once Hughes returns, especially if Hughes returns and is 100% on the other side of this Four Nations break. Again, though, team's not generating a ton. Even as good as these four games have looked and as high as the work rate's been and as fun as it's been to see this team playing some, you know, fun hockey, they're still only generating like 26 shots an hour, not a ton off the rush. It's still not enough. It's still not enough. And the amount that these best teams in hockey, like the amount of talent that they have, the amount of juice, I think is still in a totally different echelon than where this Canucks team is likely to slot. But I'm at least curious about it, given sort of what we saw from their form. But I did reemphasize for me, like, the fundamental building block, the thing we focus on and have to focus on, like, have to focus on sort of almost with more discipline than we do sometimes, is that, like, thing that matters most. The thing that matters most is what wins championships across sports. And in hockey anyway, it's are you creating that environment to score the next goal? And the truth is that across the last six games, or last six seasons, frankly, the Canucks have never really been in a contender tier in that category. And it's kind of why I've always been a little bit meh on, you know, all the win now moves that this team has made, given that they haven't really been close enough, in my view, to justify that type of posture.
You know,
and here's the last thing.
Okay,
sorry,
go ahead. Well, I was going to say, I think I take your point about the offense still struggling at different points and the goal score, you know, the 5-on-5 goals in that period are not impressive. You look at some of the underlying numbers, and just I'll take scoring chances per natural stat trick here. The Red Wings game and the Leafs game from this week, second and third most 5-on-5 scoring chances for the in a game this year for the team. Right. The number one was against Pittsburgh at home in October. Leafs and Red Wings second and third, right? And, you know, expected goals, I think they're only the two of the like three games that they've had more than three expected goals at 5-on-5, those two games. Yep. So even, you know, it didn't convert to actual like an offensive explosion or anything like that. But I mean, I was watching that Maple Leafs game and you mentioned them kind of identifying how to go cross seam against the Leafs. Like, I think they connected more east-west dangerous passes in the offensive zone in the first period of that game than they have for like weeks at a time at other parts of this season, right? So even though the goals haven't necessarily come, I think if you look just a little bit under the surface, and again, it's fits and starts, and you got to take the San Jose game too, and that wasn't impressive. But as you say, when you add it all up and consider that it is all without Quinn Hughes, for them to have like two of their more impressive scoring chance generating games without Quinn Hughes in the lineup, I think that is, at the very least, should give cause for like cautious optimism of what it could look like when Quinn Hughes is back in the lineup.
Yeah, and we don't know anything. It's such a small sample. You know, you know how I feel about using even something like scoring chances when our sample's already small. But I think you're right. And you know, the one play that really stands out to me from that Leafs game is looking materially different from so much of what we've seen of the Canucks this season was the 2-on-1 that Hedl and Drew O'Connor didn't quite connect on, right? Like, I think Hedl got the pass, but he was in too deep. And so it wasn't even really a great chance, but it was the way that those two guys got out and sort of got galloping vertically against the Leafs, stressing them out and creating, you know, a dangerous rush chance at a chance, if not an all-out dangerous rush chance, that just felt so different from so much of what we've seen from kind of like a stodgier, slower, more deliberate Canucks team over the course of the season. Like, that looked the way that I, you know, had thought and even bought into this team wanting to play when we saw them focus so intently on this side of the game or this phase of the game at training camp. And so, you know, I do think there's cause for cautious optimism is the right frame, I think, for now. And I do think there's reasonable cause for that, even though I don't know how much of it I'm buying exactly just yet. The last part of this is, one thing I thought about a lot watching the Mahomes side of this and him having maybe the worst game of his career. In fact, one of the 10 worst halves of the last 10 years.
Easily his worst, the worst game of his career. I mean, we've all watched, if you watch NFL, you've seen a lot of Patrick Mahomes games in his career. Like, I can't remember him ever looking that bad.
No, I mean, this was one of the 10 worst halves of football by EPA per dropback. And like most of the other quarterbacks in that top 10 are like Davis Mills and Will Greer and PJ Walker and stuff. I mean, it was like historically poor offensive play, especially in that first half for the Chiefs. And I do think that there's an element to this where, so the pithiest takeaway, the pithiest way to frame this, and it's not fair, but it's still how I thought about it, is, you know, the Chiefs got real close to winning the Super Bowl the way the Canucks got real close to beating the Oilers in the playoffs last year, right? Like, how many times they really pushed the Oilers? Mm-hmm. They were outscored 8-1, 8-1 through 100 minutes of hockey when it actually mattered in game 6 and 7 of the second round last year. You know, across game 6 and then the first two periods of game 7, and we're still saying like they pushed the Oilers. What are we talking about? Like, what happened was the Canucks overachieved to a point where they ended up in games against a team they truly did not measure up to at a pace that they could not handle and got flattened. And like, that's what happened to the Chiefs. The Chiefs were lucky all year. They earned that bye in part because everyone kept missing field goals against them, or they got a key call, or Isaiah Likely's, you know, toe was on the line, what have you. And they arrived here having beaten the Buffalo Bills, you know, pretty fortunately, in my opinion. And they weren't up to snuff. Now, it's not that, like, Mahomes failed in the Super Bowl, although he did, so much as it's incredible that he got them there given the flaws on the roster. Like, they overachieved to a point where they were exposed against a team that was materially better than them and just just operating at a completely different level. And I do think that that's what happened to the Canucks last season, you know? So I more than anything, I still think there's like a measure, a gap between what a real championship quality team looks like and what one that doesn't, even if they do get close and overachieve and seem to be on the precipice, looks like. I felt like last night was a reminder of that. And honestly, I think if we're being honest with ourselves, we need to look at the playoffs and understand the playoffs last season in that vein. Like, the Canucks weren't a Stanley Cup contender coming into this season because they pushed the Oilers. They didn't really push the Oilers. They got flattened when that series was at the pointy end. And that's really what was telling. That was the signal that we needed to be paying attention to. And I just, more than anything, last night just reminded me of that and of the Canucks conversations that we were having over the course of, you know, this offseason leading into this season, both on our show and sort of elsewhere.
I will also say about just like general sports takeaways from the Super Bowl is this is why insanely athletic guys will always get drafted, even if they don't produce, even if their tape doesn't look great or whatever, because Philly had the best athletes at every position on the field last night. It seemed like they were the athletically superior team at every position on the field, and it showed, and that's a big part of why they were able to dominate like they did. Okay. Little Super Bowl breakdown with some Canucks tie-ins there. I mentioned trade deadline stuff. Only 6 games remaining for the Canucks before the March 7th trade deadline. So not a lot of time to kind of see how things shake out here. They're in the final wild card spot, 3 points up on Calgary. You know, Dom's model really likes their chances to make the playoffs. But when you consider, one, the like glaring needs on the roster, which, you know, in the departure of JT Miller, even with the arrival of Filip Hedl, is obviously a center. And you would probably say scoring help in general as well, like impact forward at the top of the lineup. You consider the glaring needs, you know, the constant mandate to win, to make the playoffs from the organization, but also the high profile UFAs. Brock Besser, I should guess, is the high-profile guy, but some other interesting UFAs they have to deal with as well. Just kind of overall, I don't think, you know, as I teased that we were going to talk about the trade deadline, on Twitter somebody responded and saying, like, you guys really don't think they should be buyers, do you? And it's like, I don't know. I think they're kind of, they're not clearly in a traditional buyer or seller mode with 6 games out here. And I think the likelihood that those 6 games push them into either clear buyer or clear seller is pretty slim. So I think it's going to look a little bit different than your traditional trade deadline for the Canucks.
Yeah, well, it should, right? I mean, the Besser situation for me is a classic where, you know, this team's still a playoff team, right? They're still a playoff team. This season still matters for a variety of reasons. There's still unique opportunities and unique reasons. You know, Quinn Hughes' long-term future, Demko's contract situation, the age of some of their best players, why this season, you know, is one to not... you can't go all in on this season, obviously, but you can't ignore that there's a meaningful opportunity still ahead of this team too, right? Especially because they've actually played really good hockey, you know, across the last week. So the Besser situation for me is like a fascinating stand-in where it's like he might be too valuable a piece for the Canucks to allow him to walk if they can't come to terms on an extension without recouping some value. But he's also too important to what this team needs in terms of top 9 forward depth, in terms of being a dynamic scorer, in terms of being a power play weapon, to trade without replacing, right? So, you know, I mean, he's sort of the canary in the coal mine for this like hybrid approach where even if they determine that they have to sell Besser, can't treat him as an own rental, I think they need to replace him, probably taking some of those assets, even if they are to make that deal. Can't just be a deal made with the future in mind, even if that's the motivating factor. There needs to be, you know, a left-hand, right-hand sort of element to it, to that sort of move. As it applies to centerman, though, you know, I think the list that me and Harmon sort of produced there is a bunch of guys who are, like, there's only one guy who's over the age of 28 or 26 on that list. Everyone else is sort of like a distressed younger asset who might be available for XYZ reasons or has been rumored to be available for XYZ reasons, usually underperformance or injury or something like that. The exception that we included was Braden Schenn. Now, Elliot Friedman and Darren Dreger had reporting last week that the Blues are at least interested in gauging the market there, that the price is exorbitant. And as I was sort of considering that from a Canucks perspective, like, you know, there's players like Marco Rossi for the Minnesota Wild who would be like sexy additions for the Canucks. Or I know Josh Norris has been, you know, widely rumored to the Canucks. Obviously, he's got the relationship with Quinn Hughes. Although when you really like peer into the like beneath the surface of his deployment this season in Ottawa, like I'm telling you right now, he's Travis Green's favorite player on that roster given the way that he throws him to the Wolves. Like I've covered Travis Green coach teams long enough to know what he thinks based on his deployment changes, and I'm pretty confident if they traded Josh Norris, Travis Green would throw a fit based on how he utilizes him. So I'm guessing Norris isn't moving just off of that. But the guy that I honestly can't shake the Braden Schenn notion here, that even at a high price point, is that the sort of player and person, and with a real emphasis on the latter side of this,
yep,
that the Canucks could use, right? Someone who's won a championship, right? Who's got some weight, who can still play at a really high level, right? You know, he's not like a defensive driver, but he's a big-bodied, talented goal scorer. He's maybe slowing down a bit. He's 33. He's signed for three more seasons after this year, so through his age 36 season. But at a number, at 6.5, that, like, you know, we have to reframe a bit given what we know about where the cap's going, right? I mean, 6.5, like, if Braden Schenn was a UFA this summer, Jamie, what would your expectations for him be?
Yeah.
6 years times eight? 8.5? For sure. Like, absolutely.
I don't know. He's 33, so maybe not quite that, but at least like 4 or 5 years or something like that, for sure.
Oh, but I mean, Monahan got 5 times 5.5.
Yeah.
Sean Monahan. Like, I'm pretty confident Braden Schenn's been far more durable. Braden Schenn's won a championship. Braden Schenn's a better skater. Like, Sean Monahan was coming off a, you know, 59-point season. He'd had 17 points in 25 games the year before and 23 and 65 the year prior. He got 5.5 times 5, Jamie, and he's 30 years old. Like, I think Braden Schenn would get, I think Braden Schenn would easily get Bo Horvat money over a shorter length of time. And so 6.5 times 3 and a half, I guess, you know, to me, that looks different than we might have said a while ago. And increasingly, I'm like, man, I think that's a price somebody should pay. And I actually think that's the profile. More than taking an upside shot on, like, another young center with potential, I mean, isn't that what the Canucks have in Hedl?
Yeah.
Doesn't it feel like the Canucks should be after someone who plays, like, a heavier game, is an older player, has some, like, weight and pedigree? Like, isn't that what this team needs? Don't they need one of those, you know, I don't want to use the, like, intangibles word, but just, like, a guy who can help motivate, help show the way for some of Vancouver's younger players, perhaps in a healthier manner than some of the veterans that this team has leaned on over the past year and a half. And to me, Braden Schenn's, like, a perfect fits the bill for that type of player. You know, if he was right-handed, I'd be like, man, they should absolutely be willing to trade their 2025 first to do this. I don't think they're willing to trade their 2025 first, but for a player like Braden Schenn, honestly, despite the sort of risk and despite it being outside my usual profile that I'm looking for, I think this team might need some unusual solutions to just keep the vibes on the rails. To bring in the sort of veteran leadership that this group needs. So as I was writing that article, more than anything, I ended up talking myself into Braden Schenn, which I don't know that I expected when I started producing it.
It's an interesting argument. We got to go to break, but, you know, you pointed out in the article, like, he's more of an offensive guy than a defensive. And I think if that was kind of reversed and it was like, okay, here's the guy we can really rely in matchup roles and big minutes and, you know, big minutes against the other team's best players and all of that, then I think, like, that's exactly what they need. And as you said, the right-handed thing as well. But I remember, I mean, we had these conversations about his former teammate, Ryan O'Reilly, right? A couple of years ago, where all those things you're laying out about the fact that he's won a cup, his leadership, his value just as a person, that's potentially really, really significant. So, you know, it really comes down to the price, as always, when you're talking trade deadline targets, but at least it's another interesting name out there. And as you say, maybe a bit of a different solution other than, you know, Dylan Cousins and Casey Mittelstadt and kind of the young, okay, let's take a bet and see if this guy can figure it out here type of route, which is an option as well. We'll take a break here. As mentioned, Eric Engels from Sportsnet, he was on the ground in Montreal covering Team Canada's practice. So he heard from Coach John Cooper, heard from Sidney Crosby. We'll get Eric's perspective on Team Canada going into the Four Nations. And we can wrap up maybe with a little bit more trade deadline talk and take some of your texts as well. That's next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec Studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. And of course, Canucks Talk running for the next 2 weeks, but with a heavy dose of Four Nations talk mixed in there. And the teams got on the ice for practice in Montreal today, and on the ground at practice for Team Canada from Sportsnet was Eric Engels, who joins us now. Eric, thanks very much for doing this. How are you today?
I'm great. I mean, I'm very happy to be with you, Jamie, and to answer, first time for everything, and here we are.
Hey, buddy. Welcome to the show.
Yeah.
I was excited.
People who don't know, Thomas and I were both writing for Sportsnet.ca a very long time ago. We broke into the business together, so.
Well, there you go. Well, I'm glad
to be on the air with you.
I'm glad we could have you on. And, you know, I was excited. I knew we were going to get the reports from practice and everything. But, you know, I checked social media today and I saw you tweeting the lines from Team Canada practice. And man, I was pumping my fist. I was stoked. I'm ready to go, seeing the combinations and all that. Hey, you know, before we dive into that stuff and the power play and everything, just give us a check here. Like, what was the vibe around Team Canada practice and in the locker room talking to the guys after?
I mean, pretty cool. Like what you're really trying to figure out is, like, are any of these guys nervous? Like, you know, they're all of them play with superstars on their respective teams, but it's a different thing putting on that jersey and being led onto the ice by Sidney Crosby, Connor McDavid, and Nate McKinnon. Like, I was talking to Colton Pareko after. I was just like, are you nervous out there? And he was like, excited, nervous, but, like, you know, you're not going to get these guys to necessarily admit that, but you know it's just a different feeling. And then the line rushes start and the practice starts and John Cooper's running it and Peter DeBoer is on the ice, Bruce Cassidy's on the ice, and, you know, all this talk about the Americans and how phenomenal they're supposed to be. It's easily the best American roster I think ever assembled. And there's been some shine taken away from a Canadian team that, let's face it, is filled with some of the greatest players we've ever seen. You know, talking to Nathan McKinnon afterwards about the prospect of playing on a power play unit with McDavid and Crosby, and he's like, those two are top five ever. And it's Nate McKinnon saying it. So it's just, I think it really juices up what we're about to dig into over the next couple of weeks, right? With the Americans, with the Swedes and Finns, who will be underestimated as they are in almost every tournament and always because they've played together for years and years and they know their systems and they know how they like to fit together, are always threatening, although the Finns obviously would be a long shot to win with what's happened to their blue line. But just day one, the media storm, there was more people here than you would see even at a Stanley Cup final, which is a lot of people, as you know, Drance. And it was crazy. It was fun.
What did you learn chatting with or listening to John Cooper and asking him questions and, you know, just hearing John Cooper speak to the assembled media horde after practice?
Like, it's always fun listening to him. Anybody likes listening to him. I think what I learned just watching him talk was just how much this means to him, how much thought has already been put into being successful at this tournament, the pressure that comes with it as the head coach of the Canadian side. The support he has around him with Rick Tocchet and Bruce Cassidy and Peter DeBoer and some of the most brilliant minds in the country or in the sport for that matter, all together, and the preparation that they did to put these lines together and these combinations, knowing that they don't have time to feel their way around with this tournament. It's not like the World Cup of Hockey in 2016 where there was a 2-3 week lead up and they could jig, play different things with the team North America. This is like, you know, when you see Crosby, McDavid, and McKinnon hop on a power play unit with Reinhardt and Carr, it's not like, okay, it's the first practice, let's test this. It's like, we're going to see this. This is going to be in the game. And just listening to Cooper talk about how the thought process behind putting these things together and speaking to players and not asking them necessarily who you want to play with, but what complements your game best. is a good approach to building the kind of instantaneous chemistry you need to have to win a tournament.
Eric, we were talking about it a little bit with Greg Wyshynski in our second segment. What do you expect in terms of the reaction from the Montreal crowd when the anthem plays ahead of the Canada versus USA game?
Well, it was really subdued over the weekend. Okay, so like the Canadians were playing against two American teams. The American anthems played with a warning prior from the PA. Michel Lacroix is the best PA in all of sports, let alone hockey, saying, you know, in light of recent events, we'd ask that you please respect the national anthems. And it was really subdued. There was the first game, there was a little couple of boos that you could hear here and there. And the second game, there was almost none. But I will say that because it's Super Bowl weekend and they were 1 p.m. starts, it's the building is packed with kids. It's family weekend, and it's a few more affordable tickets in the house. And so I don't know that you'd have a politically charged atmosphere, but I guess it's a real different story when Canada and USA are playing against each other. And I think even without the political narrative taking shape over the last, you know, few weeks, as we all know, we don't need to get into the details as to why it's the case, but even without that, you know, there is rivalry between these two hockey nations, and there's potential always for an anthem to get booed because a few stupid people in the audience might just feel like, I don't care, we're playing against the Americans, and we're going to start booing their anthem. That potential is probably a lot higher than what we saw last weekend with the Devils and Lightning coming into town to play the Canadians. And I think it could be twisted into like a whole political narrative, but I think there is the fact that these are two rivals on the ice. They shouldn't be rivals as countries. I think we probably all agree on that. But, well, things have happened.
I'm curious to change gears abruptly and rather suddenly, because we'll get back to Four Nations stuff. But while I've got you, and while we were talking last segment about the Canucks' needs down the middle at center, and the idea of them potentially buying a center or center help, not just for the rest of this year, not a rental player, but a long term piece down the stretch. I wanted to ask you about Jake Evans, given the season he's having, given the uncertain contract status there. What's the latest on Jake Evans? What are you expecting the Habs to do in terms of sort of approaching an extension versus a deal and weighing that between now and the trade deadline?
Listen, Jake Evans would like to stay in Montreal and the Canadians would like to keep him, but I don't know if it still lines up for either party here, right? Like, Evans is in the midst of a contract year. He is putting up the best season in his career. He's 2 goals and 2 points away from hitting career highs that he would have set in 72 games in, I don't know what year it was, three years ago probably. And, you know, doing it in 56 games this time around, or 57 games. And he's coming into free agency at a time where the salary cap is growing exponentially. And the Canadians are not going to be a team that competes for a Stanley Cup as imminently as next season. So it makes it a complicated deal. Like, if Jake Evans, I think, was willing to accept right now on this day a 4-year deal that pays him somewhere around $4 million a year, I think he'd probably be a Montreal Canadian for the next 4 years. But I don't know if the Canadians even have that on the table for him at this juncture, with Owen Beck rising through the ranks, with Oliver Kapanen growing well in Finland, or I should say he's playing in Sweden. He's from Finland. It's a complicated thing for them to do, and that makes it more likely that he gets traded. And all the more reason for Jake to not accept anything right now and play the market, in that he'd have an opportunity to grow his profile with a playoff team. And we'll see if Vancouver ends up being one. I think they probably will be, based on whatever additions they plan on. I think they would be really wise if they were looking for a bottom six center who can play his way up and is an elite penalty killer. I don't think there's anybody else on the market that would probably be a better fit than Jake Evans. The fact that he's a right-handed center probably helps Vancouver also. So, yeah, I could see them as one of many teams that would be interested in this player. So we'll see where it all goes. If I was betting on it right now, despite the fact that I said that he would like to stay and the Canadians would probably like to keep him, he's probably more likely to be traded than kept here in Montreal.
We're chatting with Eric Engels from Sportsnet, who is on the ground, of course, covers the Habs normally, but on the ground in Montreal covering the Four Nations right now. And, you know, back to Team Canada, one of the big questions coming into today was the status of Sidney Crosby, and he put to bed any questions about that, at least for now, saying he's good to go for the opener against Sweden on Wednesday. And, you know, man, Sidney Crosby, obviously, we all remember the golden goal. He stars for the 2014 Olympic team as well. And, you know, like 2010, a lot of the other guys on the team, they weren't even playing junior yet, let alone in the NHL. But he's still here on the first power play unit. What does he mean to this team? What kind of role is he going to play in this tournament for Canada?
I mean, everything. He's the leader. He's the guy everybody looks to. And just his mere presence here, after what he went through over the last week and the uncertainty of it and how much it means for him to be here, sets the tone in a way it needs to be set. And that's what everybody said about it, right? Like Sam Einhart said that, Colton Pareko said that, John Cooper said that. And it's not like they needed to say it for us to know. We know what Sidney Crosby is about. We know what this means to him. We know this is one of the last times we're going to see him suit up for Canada. We hope that he is definitely there at the Olympics next year. But as this last week kind of showed, those situations are precarious. You never know what's going to happen. He's unbelievable. Like, there were no signs that he suffered through anything watching him skate on the ice today. And for my money, at a guy who's, what, he's a point per game with a Pittsburgh team that's not very good this year. Like, after McKinnon and McDavid and McCarr, who's a better player than him on this roster? Can you guys name one?
Yeah.
So he means a lot. He means a lot. And he is, along with Drew Doughty, the most experienced player on this roster in terms of that winning pedigree and the guy that everyone will look to in the room or on the ice. So just his ability to impact the game the way he does at 37 years old is remarkable. If you think about the greats that have led Canada over the years, and some of the performances we've seen, go back to 2002, watching Lemieux and Steve Yzerman, and 2006 even with Lemieux, like 2004, I should say, at the World Cup of Hockey, which was also partially held in Montreal. Like, I don't know. I can't think of anybody at that age who is as impactful as Crosby has the potential to be at this tournament. He's still that good. So that's the kind of regard I hold him in. I know there's some other wily vets on this team, guys like Brad Marchand. And I would say something similar about him too, but I don't know if he still plays on the same level that Crosby is capable of generating for this team. And let's put it this way. Canada's down a goal in the gold medal game, and there's a minute to 2 minutes left, and they need one. You know that 29 and 97 are getting on the ice, but you also know that 87 is going with them.
Like, yep.
I don't see how you're looking at anybody else.
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, I'm also like, we haven't seen true best on best from Team Canada really since the 2014 Olympics. I think back to those Olympics, and with all the offensive talent available to Team Canada, really the identity of that team was just kind of relentless puck possession, didn't let the other team sniff the puck, and they didn't necessarily rack up a lot of goals, but they were always kind of comfortably in control of the game. I look at some of the players farther down the roster on this version, and it's, you know, whether it's Sam Bennett or Anthony Cirelli, I wonder if we might see something similar from this version. What kind of identity do you expect this version of Team Canada to have?
You know, you look at a line of McKinnon, Crosby, and Stone, you'd be terrified to play against them. You look at McDavid, Marner, and Reinhart playing together. Reinhart had 57 goals last year. He's got 31 goals and 31 assists. Marner and McDavid both have 71 points. That those guys could score with their eyes closed. But if I'm USA, Sweden, Finland, I don't want to play against the line of Cirelli, Hagel, and Bennett. Like, I don't want to play against those guys. Those are the last guys I want to see on the ice when I get out there. Like, and then you have the potential that Marchand, Braden Point, and either Travis Konecny and Seth Jarvis.
Yeah.
One of those two. Like, you're looking at if you had to assemble a bottom six, and again, we can debate about some of the players that didn't make this roster, but when you are able to assemble a bottom six that looks like that, it speaks to assembling a team and not just a pool of talent. And those are two lines that if you go through the history of this country at best-on-best events, and I understand we're missing some of the best with guys like Draisaitl and Kucherov not there, and that's a whole other subject onto itself. Who the heck wants to play against those guys? Like, who the heck would want to? Those are two of the peskiest lines ever assembled for any team in the sport. So, and that's why, look, I understand the Americans. The Americans, I said it off the top, they're the most talented team they have ever assembled in any tournament. I don't care what anybody says. I would put them up against any American team that has ever competed at any level of hockey and give them the edge. And the talk of them being the team to beat in this tournament is probably valid and justified just based on their talent alone. But I still think Canada is the team to beat when you talk about how these lines are assembled and what other teams will have to face to get through.
Eric, it should be a blast. Thanks for the insight, and I can't wait to see how all these pieces fit together for Team Canada. Thanks for doing this.
My pleasure, guys. Good to be with you.
That is Eric Engels from Sportsnet, of course, regularly doing great work covering the Montreal Canadiens and with the Four Nations touching down in Montreal. He was on the ground at the Team Canada practice today. Final few minutes of Canucks talk here. And I mean, first of all, I'm glad he highlighted that line with Point, Marchand, and then either Seth Jarvis or Travis Konechny. I love John Cooper just putting like all of his sub-6-foot buzzsaws, puck-winning machines on the same line together. That sounds like an absolute blast to watch. But pivoting back to the Canucks here for a few minutes, you know, we were talking trade deadline in the 1 o'clock segment, and Adam from Cumberland texted this in: guys, what if they win 6 straight before the deadline with Hughes in the lineup? Do they turn into full-on buyers at the deadline? How can they not? And I responded to Adam in the inbox and I said, well, at the very least, you know, you come out on a 6-game winning streak out of the break, it makes the decision with what to do with Brock Besser much, much more difficult, I think. And there's no roster freeze on right now, so technically NHL teams are free to make trades. I think it would be a little surprising to see significant trades go down during the Four Nations. But one thing I am going to be keeping a close eye on is whether we start to get reports about the Canucks really engaging with Brock Besser on an extension, or reports that they're not doing so, right? Because you think back to All-Star breaks past, and that's a time where they really start to work on this non-hockey stuff, right? Like Elias Pettersson's contract at the last All-Star break. So I don't think we're going to get like a quote-unquote resolution to will they trade Brock Besser here, but I think what we hear about how much discussion they're having and how close they're getting over this break could be very, very telling on Besser.
Yes, exactly right. When you have some time and everyone's away from the game, and you know a player's at a casita in Cabo on the phone with their agent, like that's a good time to think about what you want.
Yep.
And so, you know, Besser and Lankinen, right? And maybe Pew Suter on this score would be sort of names to monitor to see if there is heat around those situations. You know, the Besser thing I'm really fascinated to see, just because, you know, now, so what does going 6-0 coming out of the break really mean, right? I mean, it means winning both games of a back-to-back on the road in Vegas and Utah, and then beating the Kings,
mm-hmm.
right? And then also beating the Ducks, who are a thing. And, I mean, you know, even there, like, you go 4-0 on that road trip, I think we're starting to get really optimistic in a lot of ways about where this team is trending, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, you know, that could be interesting. After the Miller trade, you know, in terms of like Forbert and Suter tier guys, not necessarily Besser, you know, what I reported and what my understanding was that how the team performed between sort of the date of that deal and the trade deadline would dictate an awful lot about sort of how the club decided to proceed with some of those players. You know, I do think there was a sense of curiosity to see how the group responded, and a willingness to sort of treat some, you know, the sorts of guys that will only return mid-rounders anyway as own rentals. Mm-hmm. But I do think the Besser situation is materially different. And my guess is that the club will be somewhat stubborn about that. I think they should be. Like, Besser's a consistent 30 goal per 82 games played guy, right? The distinction for Besser, the reason Besser doesn't score 30 in any given season, isn't how he plays usually. It's whether or not he's healthy, right? He's going to give you 30 if he's in the lineup for 82 games. That's the rate he scores at for his career. And we've seen that he can go up for 40 if things are rolling in the right way for a team. I think that's a different caliber of asset. I think that's a different caliber of consideration for this group. And so, you know, I don't know if this club's performance over small samples will change the dynamic, that if the club can't find a deal, or if they can't come to terms on something they like there, you know, if they're looking at 8 years and they decide that exceeds their risk tolerance, I think that's, you know, a decision that just has to be made as is, as opposed to something where you can be flexible and go for it, quote unquote, given where this team's at and how sort of delicate this transition into a post-Miller era is.
Yeah, and I know you've mentioned, like, okay, do you have to trade? If you don't think you're close and you're not going to get close on Besser, as difficult as it is, I do think you have to trade him before the deadline, even if the team's on a roll and they've got this post-Miller trade burst of energy and, hey, now Hughes is back and maybe Pettersson starts to show, right? Like, there's all these reasons why you could get bought in and not want to deal him. But again, if you don't think you're close and the most likely scenario is he walks in the summer, you have to find a way to make a deal. I know you've pointed out, well, okay, maybe you trade Besser and then you get the Jason Zucker replacement or someone else on the wings, right? So you're getting some value back on the asset, but then you're turning part of those returns back to kind of replace what he does in the lineup a little bit, albeit with not nearly as talented as a player. I think it probably has to look like that, so you're not completely neutering your team's ability to perform down the stretch, but I just don't see how any way you risk losing the asset for nothing rather than make a deal before the trade deadline ultimately.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's it's one of those difficult decisions that ultimately, you know, unlike some of the more complicated personnel decisions that we've been discussing over the past few months, I think this is one where there actually is a right answer.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you can own rental a player as good as Besser. So it's kind of extension or trade in my mind, given that I don't think this is a contender tier team or even has a path to be a contender tier team this season.
All right, that is Canucks Talk for today. We will be back tomorrow. We'll see what crops up around the Canucks, and of course, we'll keep diving into the Four Nations. That's tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.